fathers dwelt of old time beyond the river, even Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. All right? Now that indicates that Terah was a worshiper of other gods. Now, possibly when he left Ur to go to Haran, it may be that he was getting out of idolatry. But when he got back to Haran, he resumed his idolatry, or he may never have left idolatry. This we don't know. But Joshua says he served other gods. Now, one author that I read argues that Terah was dead under Abraham when Abraham left. And that's what Stephen means. But I wouldn't argue that question. I wouldn't argue. I would simply say this, that the best solution to me to the problem, and it is a problem, and it's a problem that I hadn't really grappled with until today or lately, I would simply say then that Haran, who died in Ur before they left there, must have been the oldest. He must have been the oldest of the group. And here was Nahor, because Abraham married the niece of Nahor. Here is his niece. And we're going to look at those fellows later. But at any rate, I think the best solution is this, that Terah was 70 years old here when he had his first son, and that first son was probably Haran or Nahor. Then it was a long time later before, if he was 70, then it would be 60 years later. 60 years later before Abraham was born. Well, that means then that Abraham, Noah had been dead 2 years when he was born. I think that's the best solution to the problem, is simply to say that here, Nahor and Haran were born early. Abraham was the youngest of them. Lot seemingly was more or less his age. Yet he was the son of Haran, probably nearly the same age of Abraham, for all we know. And so when Terah was dead at 205 years, he died. Then Abraham, being 75 years old, came on down into the land. Therefore, he was born back here when his father here was 130 years old. Now, so that'll help you solve that problem. But if you take Abraham the oldest, then he was contemporary with Noah for 52 years. If you think that he wasn't the oldest, and he couldn't be, in the light of what Stephen said. Stephen said he didn't leave Ur until his father was dead. Moses said he died when he was 205 years old. Now, as I say, one man, and this man is a very conservative scholar, one of the best books I have, he wrote. But he takes the position that possibly Stephen was thinking about Abraham being dead Terah being dead unto Abraham because of his idolatry, and Abraham left because he was going to be true to God regardless. Now you can take that. My next best commentary also takes the position that he was contemporary 52 years with Noah on the basis that Abraham was the oldest son born unto Terah. Now why don't you spend a little time grappling with that and see what you come up with? You say, well, I'm lost already. All right. Find your way out. Yeah. All right. Yes, sir. That's right. That's right. Well, no, the brother came later, but there's no account of the brother going with him. We'll come into that in just a moment. Left. That's right. No, nothing about it at all. Nothing about it at all. So I think your best conclusion, I've said, but you do have a problem there. You have a real problem. So we generally assume that Abraham, Nahor, and Haran, he was the oldest. But that doesn't follow. Now, we generally assume that on the ground that they're always spoken of in that order. But I think you'll have to say that the order deals with the importance of the individual, not the age of the individual. And that Abraham was probably the youngest of the three sons born to Terah. That's the only way you can take That's the only way you can harmonize Stephen with Moses over here. The only way. All right. Any questions? Well, I gave you something to think about. I know to get up here and put this down is kind of confusing, but if you just take those passages, take these passages we've given you here, all right, and that down here in just 12 and verse 4, 75 years old when he came, take Acts 7 and verse 4, and then these numbers here as we've given them to you here, and then you work from there, where you come up either with the fact that Peter was dead unto Abraham, because Abraham never went back. Therefore, he considered me dead because he was an idolater. He's going to serve Jehovah. Or else, he was born when the old man was 130 years old. One or the other. All right. Have any questions? Sufficiently confused? We can go on now? All right. Well, that's fine. We'll move on. All right. Now we come to the, and Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Well, that's the same thing with Noah. Noah, 500 years old, a certain age, begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. 500 years. All right. So, it didn't beget them all the same year. They weren't triplets. These weren't triplets. And so simply, he was 70 before any of his children were born, had the three sons, but he doesn't tell which the order of their birth. So we'll leave that and move on. Okay, now we come to the sixth of these generations, or the history of them. Now, these are the generations of Terah. All right, now, it seems that we would take up Abraham, but because Abraham's kinfolks are all interrelated with this, Rebecca and Rachel and Leah and Laban and all of those, so we begin with Terah. So these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father, Terah, in the land of his nativity, in Ur of the Chaldees. What? So down here, before they left Ur of the Chaldees, down here, in the land of Shinar, before they left to go up unto Haran, this one died. Haran died there. Right, and so now they are in the land of his nativity, in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, which means princess. That word means princess, Sarai. And the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. Right, now notice that Nahor married his... niece here, Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran. So he married here his niece. And Sarah was barren, and later on we learn that Sarah was Abraham's half-sister. And so here was an intermarrying that had to take place in the early days of the history of mankind. Later on, that was abolished. Right? And Sarah was barren. She had no child. And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarah, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. Now notice here, the idea was they left down here to go into the land of Canaan. So apparently, Terah had that as his destination. But when he got to Haran, he never went any farther than that. Now that seems to be the indication of that statement, to go into the land of Canaan. But now notice Nahor is not mentioned there. But later on, Nahor is mentioned when Abraham sends to Haran to find a wife for Isaac, while Nahor is living there at that time. So apparently he came later. He probably came later. And Sarah was barren and had no child. And I've already read that. I had to come into the land here and dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years. And Terah died in Haran, the age of 203. He never did leave Haran to get down into the land he was headed for. Now Jehovah said unto Abram, what? Now this apparently is after the death of his father. And that's the way I'd rather argue. So that Peor was 130 years old when Abraham was born. Now Jehovah said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, from thy kindred and from thy father's house, unto the land that I will show thee. All right, now notice the promises. Some make three promises, some make four, some make seven. I'm going to notice seven seemingly distinct promises here in this. Now the command is, get out of your country, from your kindred, from your father's house. All right, now inasmuch as Terah worshiped those gods beyond the river, according to Joshua, then God is removing Abraham from that environment, from the family environment. He did take Lot. Apparently Lot held to the religion of his father. Well, it must have been pretty weak. I mean, his uncle. And I said, now notice what he's going to do. I will show you. First, I will make of thee a great nation. Now, we're going to come back to some of these. Second, I will bless thee. Third, and make thy name great. Fourth, and be thou a blessing. Fifth, and I will bless them that bless thee. Sixth, and in that curseth thee will I curse. Seventh, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. All right, now there's a promise. I'll make of you a great nation, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now these are the ones I'm always particularly concerned about. That is, the first is, I'll make of you a great nation, and I'm going to bless you, and I'll make your name great, and be thou a blessing. I'll bless them that bless thee, and him that curseth thee will I curse. Now then, here's the second important one. And in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now there's a passage of scripture that every Bible student ought to be thoroughly familiar with. He ought to be able to quote it. That's one passage I used to require my students to memorize. I didn't have very many classes, and I couldn't bring that in somewhere and make them memorize it. Kind of hard to find one. I want them to memorize that passage. Why? Because here is a promise now made unto Abraham that is so important, and that Paul reasons on this in Galatians, the third and fourth chapters, where it deals with the promise and the law and the gospel, the relation of it. Right, now here, first of all, I'll make of thee, he said, I'll make of you a great nation. Right, now here is the national promise. Make of you a great nation. Now next, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now that's the spiritual. That's the spiritual and pertains unto the Christ. Right, now here's a twofold promise, a spiritual, national promise. Now the Jew could never see why that the law here was the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. Now he wanted to relate this to this. And what Paul argues in the third and fourth chapters of Galatians, two very important chapters. Wish we had time to stop and study, but we don't. Here then was the nation now, but let me go just a little bit further, another part of that national promise. So Abraham went as Jehovah had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abram took Sarah his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their substance, now very wealthy here, that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan. And into the land of Canaan they came. Right, now here's the great example of faith. By faith Abraham, when he was called, obeyed to go out unto a land which he was after to receive for an inheritance. And he went out not knowing whither he went. Now, he knew God had told him to go to this land. He didn't know what it was like, nor where much about it. So he just went out by faith. God told him, I'm going to take you there. And Abram passed through the land unto the place of Shechem. All right, now that's between Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. If you're familiar with that history, the geography here. Up here is Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, and here is Shechem in between those two mountains. Already came there to Shechem, seemingly a place already, under the oak of Moreh. That word Moreh means instructor or teacher, possibly a large oak, a tamarind tree, where individuals taught. Or it may be where some faithful man of God taught the truth of God. I don't know. But at any rate, it was a place of teaching. And the Canaanite was then in the land. All right, the Canaanite now, they're already there. They have it occupied. It's now their land. And Jehovah appeared unto Abram and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. And there built he an altar unto Jehovah, who removed, who appeared unto him. Right, now notice, here is the land, and the nation, and I'm going to give you this land. Right, now here is a national land promise. Now that extended over here to the cross. Here is the spiritual promise that is fulfilled in Christ and revealed in the gospel. Alright, so here's a twofold promise, spiritual and national. The national is both nation and land. I want to give you this land. That, to me, is very important for an individual to understand that in all the rest of his study of the Bible. This is one of the key passages in understanding the Scripture. Now, I'm going to hasten along and stop here in just a moment. All right. Came to Shechem under the oak of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land, and God appeared to him, and he built him an altar. Now, this word altar literally means a place for slaughter. Now, it doesn't say that he offered a burnt offering there, but that's the meaning of the word in the Hebrew, where this particular word occurs. It's a place of slaughter. So apparently, here are sacrifices that he's offering here. Of course, that goes back to Noah. Noah offered those sacrifices to Jehovah when he came out of the ark. Now, this faithful man is following in the steps of his faithful ancestor, Noah, all right, who had followed in the steps of his faithful ancestor, King Seth, back there, following in his steps. Built an altar there under Jehovah, who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence unto the mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west, and Ai on the east, all right? Now, here's just a little north. This is Jerusalem. You're a little north of Jerusalem. And here is Shechem up here. Now, between the two places, I'll put Shechem here. Between Shechem and Jerusalem, here you find Ai and Bethel. There's Ai and Bethel here. And so he built an ark here when he came here to this place between Ai and Bethel. Now, notice when he comes, he builds another altar. With Bethel on the west and Ai on the east, and there he builded an altar unto Jehovah and called upon the name of Jehovah. All right, now here's another place for sacrifice. Now, this is characteristic of these great faithful men of God, and Abram journeyed going on still toward the south. Now, your word south there is the word Negev. It's a southerly direction, all right. But this is another word for south when it comes to direction. This word refers to this section down here called the Negev. All right, now here is Beersheba, right about here, at the very north end of the Negev. And we're going to come on down here, and here's Kadesh Barnea is down here, which we'll be studying later on we may not get to that. We won't get to that in our study of Genesis. But that's where it is anyway. Now let me just read the rest of this quickly, because you're familiar with it. Just one or two things. And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt. All right, now, we followed him here from Haran to Shechem to between Bethel here and Ai, and on down here into the Negev, the south, which would be in this area. Now he moves on down into Egypt. And here's one of our most disappointing experiences in this man. He just does something here that it just sort of makes us a little ashamed of him with all the faith he's supposed to have, but it weakened him. I think you can realize in every idol there are feet of clay. Every idol has its feet of clay. So to set Abraham up as an idol, you still see some clay in his feet here. Now notice, to sojourn there for a famine, the famine was sore in the land. And it came to pass when he was come near to enter into Egypt, that he said unto Sarah his wife, behold now, I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon. And it will come to pass, when the Egyptians shall see thee, that they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will save thee alive. Say, I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may be well with me for thy sake, and that my soul may live because of thee. We would say a woman 65 began to lose some of her beauty, but you think about it for a moment. She's just halfway through. She'll live to be 127. And so she'd be, what, about a 35 or 40-year-old woman today, and a woman that I think reaches her peak of beauty somewhere around 30 to 40, along that, 42, 45. If you're 60, let's go on to 60. Wherever you want to stop there. But at any rate, she would be still be a beautiful woman. And if you've ever looked at the inscriptions and the drawings of those Egyptian women, they're the ugliest things you ever looked at. They're just plain old down east ugly, whatever you want to call it, down on the farm ugly. So evidently she'd be a beautiful woman to them. Now, what was that beautiful queen's name? Nefertiti. You remember her? You've seen her picture. She was a beautiful queen, but that's the only one I ever saw from Egypt that was pretty. Because I didn't see her in person. I just saw the picture of that stone image. That may become live because of thee. Now, I want you to look at a passage over in the 20th chapter in verse 13. This indicates here that this was sort of an agreement that they had had. Look at verse 12, Genesis 20 and verse 12. This is when Abraham deceived Abimelech. And moreover, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife, and it came to pass when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said unto her, this is thy kindness which thou shalt show unto me. At every place whither we shall come, say of me, he is my brother. Right? Indicating there that they had an agreement to that end. That so I guess there's a little disadvantage to having a too pretty a wife, don't you reckon? Everybody else is going to want her. And so they had an agreement there that she would say that she was his sister there. So it seems that this was an agreement. At least that's what Abraham says there. All right. Now he goes on down, and it came to pass when Abraham was coming to Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman, that she was very fair. And the princes of Pharaoh saw her and praised her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. Now, there's another thing about that. Free, in his book on archaeology, he says that they have found writings or in Egypt to the fact that men did put, men and Hal did put men to death for their wife, to get the wife of that one. So the Egyptians were not averse to that. That's an archaeological fact, it seems. And he dealt well with Abram for her sake. And he had sheep and oxen and he asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses and camels. Wait a minute. Yeah. She was very fair, and the prince told him about it, and he dealt well with Abraham. See, he thinks he's going to get Abraham for a brother-in-law. And he had all of these, and Jehovah plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Now, what were these plagues? We have no idea. We have any idea what they were. No use to guess at them. We don't know. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this that thou hast done unto me? You suppose maybe that Sarah told him why he was being plagued? You might guess that she did. I suspect that's where he found it out. What is this thou hast done unto me? Why didst thou not tell me that she was thy wife? Why saidest thou she is my sister, so that I took her to be my wife? Now therefore, behold thy wife, take her and go thy way. Pharaoh gave men charge concerning him, and they brought him on the way, and his wife, and all that he had. All right, so now he sends them away. But up here it is said in this verse 16, he dealt well with Abram for her sake, and he had sheep and oxen, and he asses, and men servants, maid servants, she asses, and camels. I don't know whether that means that Pharaoh gave these to him, or that Abraham had these, and he dealt well with him, giving him a good place in which to take care of him. So I wouldn't speculate on that. But at any rate now, he's ready to go back home. But we feel a little ashamed of him, that here he would ask his wife to humiliate herself in this way, do a thing like that, in order to cover up for him. You can't admire that with all of his greatness, with all of the admiration we have for Abram. We feel a little let down here, don't we? And again, he did the same thing with Abimelech. But I guess the old saying is, but none of us are perfect. So even in Abraham, we see a little mark of imperfection here. We're glad you're here. Brother Hugh, have you counted them?
41.
41. That gets those back on there?
Yeah.
Oh, everything that breathes? All right. Thank you. That's what we always count then. 41. I thought about that. Thank you for coming. A fine class. Now, for next time, we'll start here with chapter 13. 13, 14, and 15. About three chapters at a time, I think we can take something like that. There's some interesting things in here and some things we can pass over rather rapidly. All right, the class is excused. Last week, as we brought our lesson to a close in the 12th chapter, we said there that Abraham, when down in Egypt, had hid behind his wife. And I think that is correct. Don't want to be too hard on him, because he was truly a great man. Just a little disappointing that a man will do a thing like that. But nevertheless, I might have done the same thing under the same conditions. But here's a point that I intended to make and overlooked. Abraham could believe God in the first part of the chapter when God said he would make of him a great nation and give him this land, and in his seed should all the family of the earth be blessed. Now this is a promise that looks down to the future. He could accept that. But when it came to an immediate need, he felt he had to help God out. I think that's characteristic of every one of us. I can look down to death and the resurrection and believe that we'll be raised from the dead unto eternal life. But really, I can't do anything about that, can I? Not a thing in the world except just prepare for it. But when it comes to an immediate need, the need of the moment, that's when my faith so often failed. So does yours. So Abraham then, I think, teaches us a great lesson at that point, that we can believe God in something way down yonder, but immediately why our faith failed us. But it shouldn't. It should be just as strong with one as the other. All right, we come now to the 13th chapter in our lesson tonight, and I want to try to cover about three chapters each time if I can. Without rushing too much. And Abram went up out of Egypt. Now you remember the last verse says, and Pharaoh gave men charge concerning him, and they brought him on the way, and his wife, and all that he had. And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had, and Lot with him into the south. Now, the south there in the American Standard Translation is capitalized, which means the Negev. It is not a word that really means south in direction. There's another word for the south in direction. But as you think about your geography here and coming on down, this area down in here, here's Beersheba, about here. Now, that's the beginning of the Negev. Now, this area down here called the Negev or the South. I think the American Standard makes that clearer in capitalizing it than the King James does when it says he went up toward the South or into the South. Right? And Abram was very rich in cattle and silver and gold. Now, notice this is emphasized. He was a very rich man. There is nothing that is either good or bad about wealth itself. It neither condemns nor justifies. It's all in how you use it. He was a rich man and yet a man of great faith. And not only much cattle, but he had silver and gold. And he went on his journeys. Notice that's plural there, probably indicating a stop here and a stop yonder, because he was traveling in the tents and all that, from the south even to Bethel. Right, now, as he came up then out of Egypt here and came into the Negev, he came on, but he passed on by and came up to Bethel. Now, Bethel was 12 miles north of Jerusalem, 12 miles north, as Tekoa was 12 miles south. And so we think of these places in their relation to Jerusalem. Here's Jerusalem, and then Bethel, where he had spent some time before when he came into the land. Right under the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai. Right now, Ai was just a little distance from there, not very far, and his tent had been between the two. Now notice here, under the place of the altar. Now he had erected an altar there, worship God. Now he comes back to that place, which he had made there at the first. And there Abram called on the name of Jehovah. Now, we don't know what he called upon him about. Maybe there's a penitence or repentance for having lied. Maybe not, because he lied again later. Maybe it was thanksgiving that God had delivered him out of the land of Egypt. But at any rate, here he calls upon him, and I'm told by Hebrew scholars, we're told, that this word altar means a place of slaughter, or a place of offering an animal sacrifice. That this is the meaning of that. So he evidently offered a sacrifice there of some kind and called on the name of Jehovah. And Lot also, who went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. Right? Now that indicates Lot also, he was a wealthy man. I don't know whether he had this wealth when he left Haran, or whether he had accumulated it as a result of his relation to Abraham. Maybe he learned something about business from his uncle Abraham. But notice he had tents. Right? Now that indicates a large number of servants or herdsmen who looked after his flocks and his herds, would take a great number of them. So he was a man, he was likewise, only the gold and silver are not mentioned in relation to him. And the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, for their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. Right? Now this chapter here that we're studying is chapter 13. Really, if you wanted a heading for this, you could call it the separation of Lot, of Abraham and Lot. This is actually the main thing in this, is the separation of these two. Now, I think, as you're going to see later on, when we see the true character of Lot being expressed, later on, I think, and now remember, first of all, he was not a part of the promise that of the nations of the earth being blessed. That was to Abraham. Now, he had come along with him. And another thing I think we're going to see in his character, really as it's expressed in this chapter, then later on as he moved into Sodom, then later on the character of the man and his daughters after they left Sodom. I think all of that suggests and expresses a difference in character between the two men. And that's even suggested here when he chose the well-watered plain, showing that nothing, I guess, wrong with that, except it demonstrated something of his character. So if that be true, then a division between these two men was necessary. This was essential. And I think we get another lesson out of this that I want to point out in just a moment. The land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, for their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. And there was a strife between the herdsmen of Abram's cattle and the herdsmen of Lot's cattle. And the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelt then in the land. Now the Canaanites were descendants of Ham. We don't know where the Perizzites came from. Nowhere are we told of their mention a good many times. Some think that they dwelt in hamlets, small villages, or maybe moved about a lot, while the Canaanites dwelt in walled cities, as we come to learn later on. And so I don't know just when they're not listed. The Perizzites are not listed in the genealogies in chapter 10. So which of the three families they came from, I don't know. But at any rate, they are mentioned with the Canaanites a number of times. But the point is, they dwelt in the land. Therefore, their land rights had to be respected. For Abraham and Lot were actually sojourners in that land. So they had to move about here and yonder. And another thing, I think, for these two men to argue in first, with these looking on, that would be a reflection on these worshipers of God. I think that's a point there. And Abram said unto Lot, now here's where you see the magnanimous character of Abraham showing up again, and his great faith. He said, let there be no strife, I pray thee. Really, that word means literally please. Please. It was a plea to him there in a very humble way. I pray thee, please. Let's not have any strife between me and thee, and between my herdsmen and thy herdsmen, for we are brethren. They come from Tiran, we are brethren, not of course next to each other in kin, but in the family relation there. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, or please again, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Let thou take the right hand, then I will go to the left. Now, it doesn't matter if you're standing and facing the east, this war, if you're facing the north, it would make no difference. In other words, he gives him his choice of whatever he should choose, and he made that choice. Here's a thing that I have long believed, and I think division over some things is wrong. In fact, I think a disposition in a congregation that would lead to division, I think that's wrong. But if there are differences that we cannot resolve, rather than just going on and on under that condition, I think it's better to divide up, one group go one way and the other go the other way. I believe that's the best thing to do. And if there's a difference in personality clashes or even doctrinal matters, if we can't agree on doctrinal matters, now both won't be right. One may both be wrong. Or the one may be right and the other wrong. They can't both be right. I want to understand that. But if after discussing the matter they don't come to an understanding on it, then I suppose the best thing to do is just to go ahead and separate. I'd rather do that personally than stay in a group where inwardly we are divided. Now, I pointed that out in the Tower of Babel. Here, the Tower of Babel was an effort to sustain a unity externally where there was no internal unity. Right now, so God dispersed them there by confusing the tongues. Right now, here, Abraham and Lot, here and now, chance for a quarrel, or let's separate. Nothing wrong in that. And so they did. And there might have been a disposition on the part of Lot and his herdsmen, or Abraham's herdsmen, that was wrong. But for them to separate under that condition, I think, was better than to go on. And I would say that to a group. I've said it before, that if you just can't agree and can't get along, all right, divide. Maybe one of these days you'll change your mind and kiss and make up. They generally do. But if you can't, why, go ahead and separate. And it'd be better to be one. Christ prayed that we be one. And he said, the glory you've given me, I've given unto them that they may be one. So there's a possibility. But if we're not going to act on it, all right, then let's separate. Let's divide them. Right? I think Paul even made that concession that God did in 1 Corinthians 7. If a Christian husband and wife can't get along, well, it's better to live apart, but not to divorce or not to remarry, but better to live apart than to live in a constant wrangle and hassle, which is wrong and don't need to have that. I'm not justifying that, but if that's the way it is, why, the other seems to be better. Right, and Lot lifted up his eyes. That simply means he took a good look in all directions. And behold, all the plain. Now, you notice the alternate reading is circle. Literally, the word means round. It simply means he looked. When you stand upon a hill, and from up here, it is said from right along here somewhere, out close to Bethel, you had an excellent view of this whole area here. All right, and so when you stand on a hill and look, it does look round, doesn't it? Yeah, it looks round to you. Right? So here he looked at the plain, the round hill, that he could see there, and he made his choice. Now he saw then that the plain of the Jordan, the round of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before Jehovah destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of Jehovah, which evidently is the garden of Eden that we've had back in the first two or three chapters, like the land of Egypt as thou goest under Zoar. That is rich, fertile, well watered, and with grass and all of that. All right? Now, I want to remake this little map here of this part down here of the Dead Sea. You remember here, the Dead Sea here, about 48 miles long, comes in here, then comes up here, and here's what you have, they call the tongue, comes back in here. Here's the tongue. Now, this seems to have been a plain before, not the whole lake, because it's 1,300 feet deep and out there, the water is out there. So I don't think he's talking about that. But Siddim, this area right here, which is still very shallow, it seemed that this is where Sodom and Gomorrah were located. Then after the destruction, then evidently this sank or water covered it some way. But this seems to be where Sodom and Gomorrah were. And here was the Arabah with the stream running in here. And here was your Zered flowing in from this direction. So that no doubt at that time, it was much different than what it is now. Well watered, because that catastrophe there definitely made a change. All right? So now notice further. So as thou goest under Zoar, and we'll say more about that later. That was down in Egypt. One of the first places you come into is you get into Egypt in the land of Goshen. So Lot chose him all the plain of the Jordan. And Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves, the one from the other. And Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and moved his tent as far as Sodom. The other version said, picture towards Sodom. So evidently, being up here, right, in Bethel, here in Jerusalem, he moved toward the east and came down the Jordan and worked his way around on one side or the other, probably this side. So this is before Moab and Ammon had come in, the Edomites and others. And he moved on around, apparently, and pitched his tent towards Sodom. Now, whether he came that way or came around this way, I don't know. But this is a better area here to come. Now, so probably he came, anyway, he dwelt in these cities as he came on down, but he pitched his tent towards Sodom, eventually ending up in Sodom. You've heard sermons on that, I'm sure. Pitching one's tent towards Sodom, but after a while, one comes to dwell in Sodom, and then Sodom comes to dwell in the individual. For he embraced, I think, some of the dispositions of Sodom. Now, notice. Now, the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners against Jehovah exceedingly. Now, they're before Jehovah, against Jehovah, or the word before Jehovah here. Now, God recognized, now, wicked exceedingly. Now, these people of Sodom were descendants of Canaan, who was the son of Ham. You have that back in your 10th chapter there, and that they extended on over here to Sodom. Gomorrah, this area. Well, that's an interesting point. So he wasn't concerned with that. He was thinking about, and this shows a part of his disposition, that he's looking to that area which is best suited for his own, I'm going to say, selfish mood. Now, the Peter speaks of his righteous soul. I never could understand how Peter could call him that, and I know Peter did, so there'll be something about Lot that I don't know. I don't understand. But I don't know a thing in the world about him that ever impressed me as being what I'd call a really righteous individual, but it may have been. It may be that he was much better man than he impresses us with being. But at any rate, Jehovah said unto Abram, after that Lot separated from him, lift up now thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art, northward and southward and eastward and westward. That is all four directions. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. That word forever means for a long time. Actually, the word means age lasting. As long as a particular age shall last. It doesn't mean eternal as we think of it. For the Sabbath was to be an everlasting covenant. Well, what does that mean? Just as long as the age should last. God said, I'll give you this land forever. That would be as long as the age should last. So remember that. That this word forever is used in the Old Testament, and I think the New, means age lasting. All right? So therefore, when I find the word forever, then I need to look at the context in which that is used. Now, if back here, talking to Abraham, that means as long as this age shall last. When you come to Moses, that means as long then as the Mosaic shall last. If it pertains here to the period under Christ, it would be as long as the present time lasts. Now, if you're talking beyond the judgment, and here you have forever, beyond the, that's beyond the judgment. Now, this is eternal. So, this is, you're not dealing with time. So, when you read that word, stop and consider the context of it, that you might better understand what you're dealing with. All right? So, here then, you lift up your eyes. You look to the north, you look to the south, look to the east, you look to the west. Now I'm going to give you this land.